accession number 24629.
Lieutenant Commander Collis, Royal Navy, Reel 3.
Well, as I say, we were employed on the battleship covering force for the Russian convoys. And there was one incident when the Battle of the North Cape, as it was called later, the convoy escort had sighted the enemy, and the Scharnhorst, I think, had come out, plus some destroyers. And so they sent out a sighting report to the Admiralty that they were engaging enemy in such and such a place at such and such a time, etc. Now, this was a signal that we picked up as well, you see. Now, chief telegraphist came on the bridge and reported to the captain that he'd heard this signal and he'd written it out and showed it to the captain, this sighting report. He said, but the Admiralty haven't answered, sir, haven't acknowledged. So he said, shall we repeat it? Because the Admiralty might hear us, you see. And the captain said, no, wait 2 minutes and see if anybody comes up. The captain didn't want to transmit because it gave his position away if he did. So he quite rightly said, wait 2 minutes. And in that 2 minutes, who should come up but Simonstown. Now, Simonstown is in South Africa. And so it went from one pole to the other pole. Now, this was because when you send out a radio signal, a noise goes out, and it hits the ionospheric level, which is up in the sky, and it varies in height from time to time depending on the weather conditions. You can actually work it out, predict it a bit, which a lot of Wrens were used during the war to predict the ionospheric level so that we would get good communications. But because it goes up, hits the ionospheric level and then comes down, it might skip over the British Isles, and lands down somewhere in South Africa in the area. So then Simonstown immediately transmitted it, because it's a shore station, it didn't matter, and that hit the ionospheric level and landed in London. So it went that way, and that way, you see. And the captain, quite rightly, didn't transmit to give our position away. Anyway, that's what started the battle going. And it taught me a sanitary lesson in communications and how fragile communications are. These days, of course, we have satellites and we have enough of them to bounce signals around the place. But sitting where we are at the moment, near sea level, surrounded by quite a lot of land on sort of three sides, we can't get satellite signals. So they're not perfect by any means. Anyway, in those days they were even more primitive. But it was quite exciting at the time. And we were rushing up there to try and give them support. But we didn't, it was all over by the time we got there.
And had the Scharnhorst sunk any British ships?
No, it had. In its past history, because it had been a raider out in the Atlantic, but not on this particular occasion. It was beaten off by the escorts, and it turned tail and went back into harbour. I think they'd learned a big lesson from the Bismarck, because the Bismarck forced on and came out, and as you know, it was lucky that we managed to hit her steering gear with a torpedo from the aircraft, which made her turn around in circles. It jammed the rudder. But if it hadn't done that, she would have got away. You see, Germans build ships to stay afloat. Well, so do we, but we live in our ships, and therefore, to make things more livable in, we have bulkheads with doors. The Germans don't. They don't live in their ships, or they didn't. They just man them to fight. In other words, to do anything. So, instead of going through bulkheads, you had to go up the top and then down again. We walk through. Now, this means that the watertight bulkheads in the ship's construction are much stronger, and it takes a lot of sinking. They can flood compartments and not sink, because they've got more compartments than we had. And that's the difference in the construction. And it also was the reason, in some ways, that when German ships sank, we used to drown more German crews than our chaps did, because our chaps could get out easier. They couldn't. It's quite a serious loss of life through the construction, anyway.
Were you all disappointed that you'd missed your chance?
Yes, you know, yes, we were all sort of geared up. I say one time I remember when we were in the Home Fleet, this wasn't on convoy duty, the RAF reconnaissance had said they'd lost the Tirpitz, and the Tirpitz had come out of Germany, come up to the Skagerrak and out into the North Sea, and they'd lost it in the fog, so they didn't know where it was. And we were sent off from Scapa Flow to go and search for it. And we were closed up to action stations for 6 days, expecting to meet this great ship. And we never did. But living for 6 days at action stations is a bit tedious, because as I said, my day action station was 6 decks down. If we'd been sunk, we wouldn't have got out of there at all. It's like being in a submarine, you know. We were too low down altogether to get out. But we had sandwiches to eat, and that was basically what we had to eat. And such things as going to the lavatory and loo, you know, the heads and things like that. We had a bucket, you know, and we... It was fairly primitive all round.
And how did you cope with the lack of sleep?
Well, we used to sleep, you know, we would take it in turns to sleep and take it in turns to watch. When you close up, once you set up the plot and set everything going, until you go into action, there's not a hell of a lot to do. So you only need two chaps awake at a time. But when you're in action, you need everybody awake. So we used to, you know, doss down on the deck and in the corner and sleep as we could. This is why I also was a good at sleeping. Sleep in trains any way you like. But
when you went off on these convoys, how long were you at sea?
Well, we used to, it was about 3 to 4 weeks at a time. We used to come back to Valfjord and replenish and things like that. I remember one time we used to go to, there was a fjord in the north of Iceland called Akureyri, and for our own protection we used to stream paravanes. Now, do you know what paravanes are? They're anti-mines. They're rather like a trawler streams its trawling net. We stream nets, or stream wires, from the bow. Now, this wire is a particular type of wire. It's what we call a serrated wire. It's very tough, and very, if you ran your hand down it, you could cut your hand quite easily. And it's a pretty solid wire, very difficult to splice. And attached to this wire, we had two paravanes, which are scoops, really, rather like the otter boards in a trawler, that keep the thing going out, away from the ship. And so we used to steam along with these paravanes out and this serrated wire. And we could put on the serrated wire every now and again cutters, which were sort of like jaws, like a pair of scissors. These scissors type blades had sort of sharp cutters on them, and they would be fixed to the wire, and the mauled mine coming down the wire would get jammed in one of these scissors sort of devices and eventually be cut through. And the mine would go floating away. That was dealing with sort of mauled mines. There were other sort of acoustic mines and pressure mines that we had to contend with too. But as I say, we used to go, one day we went into Akureyri and we were picking up the covering, the paravanes, and jammed in one of the paravanes was a baby whale. And it was drowned, but it was quite interesting to pick up a baby whale unexpected on your paravane.
And what sort of runs ashore did you get there?
We didn't. What used to happen, Iceland the Icelandic people are very proud people, like most nations are, and they had been invaded first by the British, who had taken over their country with the agreement of the Danish government in exile, but the local Icelandic government didn't agree with this. But anyway, the British invaded and occupied the island, and then they were relieved by the French Canadians. Now, the French Canadians rather misbehaved themselves. In other words, there was a certain amount of rape went on and things like that. And so the Icelandic people were pretty anti any uniform whatsoever, would be it Air Force, Army, or Navy or anything. So we were very careful in the Navy to keep out of the way of the local population. And for any recreation, we used to organize possibly some games and things like that to play up the head of the field where we were anchored, which was well away from the local population. Also, we set our own canteen up there, which didn't serve alcohol, but cups of tea and coffee and things like that and soft drinks. But on the whole, we made our own entertainment. Most times our stays in harbour were for about a week or so, and most people were occupied in A, catching up on some sleep, and also making and mending clothes and sorting them out and that sort of thing. So there wasn't a great... They knew they couldn't go ashore, and it was explained to them how the Icelandic people didn't like foreigners in uniform. In fact, I had a cousin who worked for the Austin car manufacturer, and he married an Icelandic girl. And I was asked by her to go and see her parents in Reykjavik. So I wrote to the parents in Reykjavik, and they obviously got the letter because I had a reply saying, if I was coming in uniform, would I come at night? And we had to wear uniform there. We didn't carry civilian clothes anyway. So I duly appeared, and they were a little bit standoffish at first, but they thawed out and became quite friendly. And, they then explained to me why they'd asked me to come at night, because they didn't want their neighbours to see that they were fraternising with a naval person. And so, okay, that didn't worry me. But that's the sort of... You had to deal with that sort of situation as it arose. It was a pity we didn't get in on the battles of the North Cape, but there it is. I left the Anson in 43, And I have volunteered, and you should never volunteer for anything in the services, but for submarines. So I went to Blythe, HMS Elphin, where we did a submariner's course, and there were 32 of us in this class. And to cut a long story short, I failed the course, and so did one other chap. And out of the 32, we were the only two that survived the war. So fate took a slight hand in my future, I think, there.
Were you disappointed?
Yes, I was. I was. What happened was that we had a small U-class submarine, HMS Upright, which was a nice little submarine, carried a crew of about 38, I think it was, quite small. And we did our sea training in this. Now, it was my turn to catch a trim. In other words, I was the one in command as it went down, and I had to flood the tanks and catch the trim when we were going down. This all was taking place in the North Sea. It wasn't any war detachment, this is a training period, you know. Well, much to my surprise, we took a nose-down attitude. And as you're still going forward, if you get a nose-down attitude, the whole submarine becomes a plane. In other words, if you're going forward, you go deeper and deeper and deeper, you see, because it drives you down. No matter what you do with your hydroplanes to put them to go up, it's not enough. So by this time I stopped in main engine propulsions, and we were still going down gently. And fortunately, the Dogger Bank is not very deep. It's only about 90 fathoms. And so we gently hit the bottom. And by this time the captain was out of his cabin and in the control room and wondering what the bloody hell I was doing. So he took over command, and we settled on the bottom. And then he started an inquiry as to how we got into this situation, you see. We were quite safe, no damage done. And what had happened is that a sailor had brought on board a coil of wire. Now, that's about 120 fathoms of wire coiled up into a coil. They're quite heavy. And he put it in the four ends of the... That's quite a normal place to stow it, in the submarine. Well, I hadn't taken this wire, because I didn't know it was there, into my calculations of the trim. And the result was we were bow heavy. And it was my fault, because I was the officer in charge, and I should have known about it. So eventually, I was sent for by the captain SM, the captain of submarines, Captain Claridge, and he said, "Do you know, Collis," he said, "you've done very well here, except for this one incident." And he said, "We're not that short of submariners." So he said, "I think you'd better go back to general service." And he said, "I'm sure you'll make your mark wherever you go." Which I thought was a slight backhander, but I trundled back to general service.
Were you a sub-lieutenant by this time?
Yes, I was a sub-lieutenant by then. And I got promoted in the Anson to sub-lieutenant. And R&R, don't forget, so I was wearing crisscross stripes. And then I disappeared to join a new corvette that was being built called Leeds Castle, and in Sunderland. And the I duly reported to the officer in charge of the Sunderland area and said I'd come for HMS Leeds Castle. And he said, "Oh, she's building at Pickersgill's Yard." And so he said, "Have you got anywhere to stay?" And I said, "No." And he said he sorted out with the Wren secretary some lodgings for me to go to in Sunderland. And Mrs. Curry. And she was a wonderful woman in many ways, because She'd outlived three master mariners, and she was only a short lady, but she was very strict. And the instructions to us, to me anyway, was that I could come and go as I pleased, but she knew I had to. And she said, there'll always be a hot meal here for when you come in. And she said, but I'm not entertaining any women here, and you must not go to bed with your boots on. So I said, right, I wouldn't. So duly reported to Leeds Castle, and she was still building. And Pickersgill's yard is a private yard, or I don't know whether it still exists even, but it was in those days, and run by a Mr. Pickersgill. And we were there over the winter period, so it was pretty chilly, especially on the northeast coast there. And there were several of us standing by this ship, R&BR, first lieutenant, myself, and a sub-lieutenant R&R. There was another R&BR lieutenant and one other sub-lieutenant. And the four of us took it in turns to be sort of duty boy of the staff that were standing by. And we had a little office in the yard, and it had an open fireplace, and the yard supplied us with some coal and wood, and we used to sit in this little room in case we were required for anything. Now, I was sitting there one Saturday afternoon, and the door opened, and in came an elderly man, very upright, and obviously I realized he was a man of some authority, because he was wearing a dark coat with an astrakhan collar, and he obviously, and he had a bowler hat, and so he was not the average docky. And so I stood up, and I said, good afternoon, see, not knowing who this chap was. And he didn't say anything, took his coat off, hung it up on the hook behind the door, took it in his bowler hat as well, and looked around, and took the only other chair there by the fire, and he said, what, no spittoon? So I said, no, sorry, no spittoon. He said, well, would you like a spittoon? And I said, well, I don't think many of us smoke, so, or chew tobacco. And he said, oh. He said, they won't let me have one either. So I said, oh. And wondering who was this fellow was, you see. He said, but I got over the problem. And I said, oh, how do you do that? He said, well, I've got a big knee-hole desk. So their brain was beginning to tick that this fellow is something in the management side around here. And he said, you know these knee-hole desks? Very nice. So I got one of my mates to make me a coir mat. Now that's a rope mat that sailors can make, And he said, I put it down on my feet, and I chew my tobacco, and when I want to use the spittoon, I use the mat and go, and down it goes, you see. He said, you know, after a week it's fit to smoke. I said, well, is it, you see. Then I cottoned on who he was. He was Mr. Pickersgill, you see. And he then went on to ask me if I was being treated all right, and were they looking after me, and this, that, and the other. And he said, son, anything you want, you come and see me. And he said, don't let them stop you. You come and see me. And he was Scottish gold. And he was a very nice man indeed. And he'd been brought up the hard way in the right through the yard and everything else. And he built good ships too, because he wasn't frightened of leaving his office and walking around the yard and seeing the men were doing their job. And they all loved him. Anyway, that's Mr. Pickersgill as building Leeds Castle. And Leeds Castle was a new type of castle class corvette. We had the flyer class, which were sort of converted trawlers or modelled on the trawler line. But this was a new concept altogether. And they were slightly bigger than the flyer class, and they carried 90 men. And they had good ASDICs, that's the anti-submarine equipment, and also they had what we called a squid. Now, when you attack a submarine, having picked it up when it's dived and you've got it on the ASDICs and things like that, you have to drop depth charges. But as you're approaching the submarine, you lose contact. The contact's too close, and thus you lose contact as you go over the submarine. And it's slightly guessing by God as to where you drop your depth charges and what depth you set them off at, because each depth charge has a pressure gauge on it, which you can turn to resist certain pressures and go off at that depth, a certain depth, you see. So it would be much easier and more accurate if you could devise a gun that would throw a depth charge from the ship ahead of you while you still had ASDIC contact. And this squid was a three-barreled gun and mounted aft. We eventually had them mounted forward, but initially they were mounted aft, and they used to throw quite a sizable bomb or depth charge over the ship and burst about 100 yards, or hit the water about 100 yards ahead of the ship. And thus you still had contact, and it became much more accurate to be able to sink a submarine. Mind you, if the bombs were going off the shallow depths, you knew all about it, because you were steaming into quite a large explosion.
What sort of speed could they do?
Well, maximum speed was 15 knots. Now, they were, you remember, the convoy, close convoy work, such as slow convoys, was average speed of 10 knots. So we had 5 knots in reserve to dash about a bit.
When was that corvette actually launched?
She was launched and commissioned in 1943, in just before Christmas, 1943. And I spent, what was it, about 3 years, no, 2.5 years there. 2.5 years in that one. On convoy duties, mainly to Gibraltar. And we used to leave Gourock, because we were based at Gourock, and go out into the Atlantic to 18 West, having picked up a convoy from Northern Ireland and that sort of thing, and go down 18 West and then go down in the middle of the Atlantic and then in again, trying to avoid mainly the aircraft from France, which were German aircraft based in France, and also, of course, submarines. And we used to escort about 90 odd ships and that sort of thing, which was quite a sizable number of ships. I mean, say they used to be drawn up in columns, and the distance across the front of the convoy would be 10 miles, you know.
And were the supplies for the Gibraltese people? Or?
No, they were somewhere. I mean to say, we used to do a little trade in this game, in so much that, being based at Gourock, there was a hotel called the Bay Hotel in Gourock, and there was a large blonde lady who was the manageress of this hotel. And we used to drink there occasionally, because it was not that far away from the pier where we were secure. And she was complaining that she couldn't get any sherry. So we said, oh, have you got any empty bottles? So she said, we've got plenty of empty bottles. We said to her, give us your empty bottles. So we used to secretly carry on board a lot of empty bottles, and we used to stow them in magazine racks and things like that, and take them down to Gibraltar. When we got to Gibraltar, we were there for 5 days before turning around and bringing a convoy back. The main convoys used to go to we went into Gibraltar to naval dockyard there and get supplies and refuel. The convoys used to go on down round Cape of Good Hope and to the Far East and things like that. Some used to come into the Mediterranean.